welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Monday, June 29th, 2020. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region, and each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. And now, let's take a look at today's weather. Breezy and humid today, with intervals of clouds and sun. Mostly cloudy and humid tonight. Mainly cloudy and very humid tomorrow, with a shower or thunderstorm in spots in the afternoon. Across the Des Moines area today, expect a high of 89 with a low of 71. Partly sunny, breezy and humid. Mostly cloudy and humid tonight. On Tuesday, a high of 85 with a low of 70. Rather cloudy and humid. And on Wednesday, again, a high of 85 and a low of 70. Showers and thunderstorms. Across the area today, breezy and humid with intervals of clouds and sunshine. Winds from the south at 10 to 20 miles per hour. And on Tuesday, very humid with showers or thunderstorms in spots in the afternoon. Winds east to southeast at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Our sunrise today was at 5:44 a.m. and will set at 8:53 p.m. Our moonrise today, 2:57 p.m. and will set at 1:53 a.m. And now let's take a look at the first article in today's Des Moines Register. Kim Norvell writes, "Your home could be at greater risk of flooding. Far more vulnerable than maps by FEMA indicate." An estimated 294,000 homes and businesses in Iowa are at substantial risk of flooding over the next 3 decades. Tens of thousands more than show up on the Federal Emergency Management Agency's flood maps, according to new data released Monday. First Street Foundation, a nonprofit organization that enlists top academic experts to evaluate U.S. flooding hazards, analyzed nearly every home and business in the country to determine its flood risk over the next 30 years based on past natural disasters, climate change models, and the chances of heavy rainfall, like the flash flood that affected thousands of homeowners in Des Moines 2 years ago. Nationally, First Street Foundation found nearly 70% more properties at risk than were listed on FEMA's flood maps, the standard used by owners and lenders to consider purchasing flood insurance. It found 12.1% more properties at risk in Iowa. "We're talking about millions of homes that have this flood risk, and people have no idea," said Matthew Eby, the executive director of First Street Foundation. Eby said he hopes people consult the information when they purchase a home. Decide whether to obtain flood insurance, purchase backflow preventers to stop overflow from drains, or install rain gardens and other stormwater management systems. The information is searchable by address on First Street Foundation's website. "I hope they feel empowered now to do something, to understand where the risk is and, more importantly, what that risk is," he said, "because up until this point you really had no idea." In Iowa, where devastating floods displaced hundreds of homeowners and resulted in federal disaster declarations in 1993, 2008, 2016, 2018, and 2019, the flood risk spreads far beyond the Missouri and Mississippi rivers that bracket the state, according to First Street Foundation. The new model picks up properties near smaller streams and tributaries and identifies areas where heavy rainfall could lead to inundation, said Jeremy Porter, Director of Research and Development at First Street Foundation. The rivers are covered pretty well. Then you see all of these arms that are coming off the river that aren't covered by FEMA, he said. Anytime the river floods, those flood also, but they aren't covered by the special hazard area. Iowa has gotten warmer over the last 30 years, and scientists expect in the years ahead will get even hotter, a shift that's likely to bring more frequent and intense rainstorms. Already in Iowa, 6 of the 10 wettest years on record have come in the last 13 years, according to a USA Today Network analysis of rainfall data kept by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, dating to 1895. First Street Foundation's models take into account climate change patterns and predictions. FEMA's doesn't. The nonprofit calculates flood risk through 2050, while FEMA looks at a point in time. Things are changing with rainfall patterns, and so the floodplains of today are going to be different than the floodplains of 10 years from now, said Eric Tate, Associate Professor of Geographical and Sustainability Sciences at the University of Iowa. Polk and Dubuque counties picked up the most properties at substantial risk of flooding, meaning they could be affected during a 100-year flood, the same parameter FEMA uses for its maps. Polk County, home to Des Moines, gained 5,506 properties at risk, for a total of 10,723, or 5.5% of all properties in the county. Dubuque County, along the Mississippi River, gained 5,498 properties, for a total of 6,960, or 13.6% of all properties in the county. Meanwhile, Dubuque and Sioux City gained the most risk among Iowa cities. All Iowa cities included in the First Street Foundation's data show nearly 1,000 or more properties at risk of flooding than currently mapped by FEMA. Those include Dubuque at 3,578, Sioux City at 3,382, Council Bluffs at 3,196, and Des Moines, 2,893, Waterloo, 1,926, Cedar Rapids, 1,673, Mason City, 1,203, Ottumwa, 1,172, Decorah, 1,030, Clinton, 940, and Davenport, 920, all risk ranges from minimum to extreme. Each home or business has a rating of 1 to 10 on the First Street Foundation's flood factor, based on cumulative risk of flooding over a 30-year mortgage. About 30% of properties in Iowa identified as having a flood risk face an extreme risk, including 81 addresses in Des Moines, according to the data. While First Street Foundation's model showed 294,000 properties facing risk of flooding in a 100-year event, 141,300 more homes and businesses than mapped by FEMA, it also identified 391,000 properties at risk during a 500-year flood event. Of those properties, 101,000 were categorized as facing almost certain risk, with a 99% chance of flooding at least once over the next 30 years. FEMA does not consider a 500-year flood in its maps, though they have been increasing in frequency. Houston had floods of that magnitude in 2015, 2016, and 2017. In a statement to USA Today, Lizzie Litzow, press secretary for FEMA, said the agency is working with some communities to identify future risk and develop non-regulatory tools to help them see how their risk could change. She did not specify which communities. Iowa is working with FEMA to include in its map a 6.5-year study of every stream in the state that shows the probability, extent, and depth of flooding, said Date Young, associate director of the Iowa Flood Center. We were able to refine boundaries and make them more accurate, he said. Litzow said First Street Foundation's maps and FEMA's will complement each other to give citizens a more comprehensive understanding of flood risk. FEMA's maps are designed for making decisions on floodplain management and for ensuring residents' safety during a flood, she said. First Street maps should be used to inform someone's decision to acquire flood insurance or take an action to reduce their individual flood risk. FEMA is constantly working to improve the production of the flood insurance rate maps within the context of changing conditions. We're exploring ways to leverage new technologies and provide flood information more efficiently, accurately, and consistently across the nation, said David Morstad, Deputy Associate Administrator for Insurance and Mitigation, in a statement. FEMA's flood maps remain the backbone of effective floodplain management. Local adoption of minimum standards based on the maps has resulted in $100 million in avoided losses over the last 40 years. Also on the front page, despite COVID-19, Biker Rally will go on. 3-day event typically brings 10,000 to Algona. Despite requests from local leaders to cancel because of the coronavirus pandemic, Abate of Iowa plans to hold its annual motorcycle rally in north central Iowa, a beer and music free-for-all that typically attracts about 10,000 bikers over 3 days. It's the 19th year in Algona for the Freedom Rally, held on a farm the group owns northeast of town. Organizers say the July 2nd through the 4th event is a big fundraiser for the nonprofit group, which supports biker safety and training. Governor Kim Reynolds' decision to lift a ban on large events beginning on June 10th made it possible for the group to hold the event, said David Duffy, Abate State Coordinator. "We're taking all the precautions necessary to make this safe," he said. The opposition of local government and health officials to the rally is unusual for Algona, a community of about 5,400 that typically welcomes the riders and the annual cash infusion they bring to grocery stores, restaurants, hotels, and other businesses. The group held the rally for 17 years in Humboldt before moving it one county north to Algona in 2002. "We have a good relationship with them," said Algona Mayor Rick Murphy. "The bikers are friendly, they're fun to visit with, but this year everyone is a little more on edge." Local leaders worry the event, attracting bikers from across the country, could make Kossuth County a hotbed for COVID-19. So far, the county has seen few cases. Just 32 people in the county of roughly 15,000 had tested positive for the coronavirus as of Sunday, with one hospitalization and no deaths. "People are a little discouraged that that could all be thrown into the wind," said David Penton, the Kossuth County Emergency Management Coordinator. "We don't want to be another Florida." Naturally, areas where large groups have gathered at beaches, bars, and restaurants have seen spikes in coronavirus cases. Duffy said the 160-acre farm can easily accommodate 15,000 campers, even with space for social distancing added in. And the group is incorporating distancing recommendations throughout the camp, from spacing out the line for beverages and food, to urging riders to spread out during the musical performances that run all day and well into the night. Abate, or a brotherhood aimed toward education, is encouraging riders to limit the number of trips they take into Algona for food and drink. And the group has asked participants to respect businesses' limits on the size of groups that can gather in grocery stores and restaurants, said Duffy, adding that he has hired a cleaning crew to help disinfect venue facilities. On the rally website, the group states that all participants will have to sign a form asking them if they recently have been to a coronavirus hotspot, have had contact with anyone diagnosed with COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus, or have symptoms themselves. The form says answering yes to any of these questions is grounds for denial of admission, and asks those who are admitted to do your best to adhere to all COVID-19 guidelines set forth by the state and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But also on the website, the group says that social distancing is a suggestion by the CDC, not a law. This rally was created and called the Freedom Rally to promote freedom of choice. Attending is just that, freedom of choice. Murphy said he and other government officials emailed Reynolds' office, suggesting she reconsider lifting the ban on large gatherings, Murphy said, and he heard nothing back. Without broader state action, local leaders don't feel they can do much to prevent the event. "It's a private organization, on private property," Murphy said. "They have every right to hold the event." Kossuth County Supervisor Jack Pleth said some residents wanted the board to cancel the group's liquor or vendor license, but that would just bring more people into Algona's bars, grocery stores, and restaurants. And Plass said he didn't feel like he could treat Abate's rally differently than other large gatherings, including graduation parties and weddings, that have occurred recently. Plath and Penton said Kossuth County is already seeing more COVID-19 cases as the onset of summer has brought people to nearby tourist destinations, such as the Okoboji Lakes region, which has seen a spike in positive tests. Dickinson County, home to Iowa's Great Lakes, has had 237 cases as of Sunday, the majority of which have occurred since the Memorial Day weekend. Health officials say they're encouraging Algona area residents to get groceries and run errands before the bikers hit the area. Duffy said Abate is making 5,400 masks available to volunteers and workers at the rally, and will sell masks to others. In addition, it is working with County Emergency Management to have a trailer on hand in case someone does become ill and should be quarantined. Rachel Ventescher, an Algona doctor, said the Kossuth Regional Health Center typically has additional staff on hand during the rally to help anyone who may get hurt. Our staff prepares for the A-Bay rally every year, Ventescher said. This year is just a little different. Also on the front page, man charged in Karma bar shooting that left one dead. A man described by friends as a beacon to others was shot in the head and killed outside a bar just north of Des Moines early Sunday morning. Two women caught in the gunfire outside Karma Ultra Lounge were shot and survived after driving themselves to the hospital. Police have arrested one man in connection to the shootings and charged him with reckless use of a firearm. Sir William Beckish, aged 29, was hosting a birthday party for a friend at the Karma Ultra Lounge when shots were fired near a large crowd outside the bar at 1:49 a.m. Beckish was found with a gunshot wound to his head. He was transported to the hospital and later died from his injuries, according to a sheriff's office news release. The investigation is being treated as a homicide. Beckish was described as a kind, caring, and genuine father by Cameron Middlebrooks, president of the NAACP of Des Moines, who grew up with Beckish in Des Moines. He was loved by the city, Middlebrooks said. I'm still in a little bit of shock. Beckish was full of life and ideas and was just getting started in his career as a chef and party planner, Middlebrooks said. Beckish opened his own soul food restaurant, Sir's Kitchen, on Des Moines' east side in September of 2018. The restaurant closed 10 months later, and soon after, Beckish became a chef at Club 525, an East Village restaurant and nightclub. He was also a party host and promoter. He was all about having fun and bringing the community together, Middlebrooks said. I can't think of anybody that had a problem with this guy. Middlebrooks said she had seen hundreds of Facebook posts about Beckish's death Sunday morning, many describing him as a light in this world who could brighten any room with his infectious smile. There's so many people, we can't believe this happened to him, he said. Justin Lewis, age 30, of Des Moines, described Beckish as a close friend. Growing up, he lived down the street from some of Beckish's cousins. Beckish was best friends with Lewis's cousin, Frank Renfro, Jr., and had a child with another one of Lewis's cousins. Beckish was family, Lewis said. Sir has always been there. We're connected, he said. Lewis said Beckish's death is like reliving the death of his cousin, Renfro Jr., who was murdered at age 22 in 2013. He said Beckish was by his side after the death of his cousin. Sir was there, just being the light and loving on people in the midst of losing his best friend, Lewis said. I just remember, in that dark hour, Sir William just being hope for us. That's just one instance of him being a beacon and a positive light that he's always been. Lewis described Beckish as everybody's biggest fan, their counselor. He said Beckish had no strangers in the community. He was also rooting for everyone and never had anything negative to say about others, Lewis added. You make connections on this journey of life with people and you never forget their impact when they leave. He has made such a positive impact on the Des Moines community, Lewis said. I think that's why it hurts so much. Carletta Sanders, Beckish's mother, spoke at a community prayer event held Sunday at Evelyn K. Davis Park. He loved so hard and so much, Sanders said through heavy tears. He was an amazing, amazing man, and he cared about everybody. Last night was one of the hardest things I've ever gone through in my entire life, but guess what? I'm still standing. I'm a child of God. My son was a child of God. I know that he was something special, and I know that he's going to live on in my heart and in my soul and in all of your guys' spirits. The Polk County Sheriff's Office responded to Karma Ultra Lounge at 4995 Mulhay Road at 1:26 a.m. Sunday after staff called for help dispersing a crowd of about 500 people inside and outside the bar, according to a Sheriff's Office news release. Shots rang out outside the bar at 1:49 a.m. Beckish was found with a gunshot wound to his head and later died of his injuries. Two women with gunshot wounds transported themselves to the hospital and survived. A 33-year-old woman was shot in the leg, and a 40-year-old woman was shot in her torso. Beckish and the two women were patrons at the bar, Lieutenant Jeff Roman said. Gordon Jerome Johnson, age 35, of Des Moines, was arrested Sunday and charged with reckless use of a firearm and possessing a weapon as a felon. He was also booked into Polk County Jail at 3:16 a.m., according to the Polk County Jail's inmate roster. Police reports state that Johnson was at Karma Ultra Lounge and was observed discharging a firearm in a reckless manner outside before running west across Mulhay Road and hiding the firearm a Ruger 9mm, in a storm drain in front of Tom's Auto Sales. It's unclear, based on police reports, whether the shots Johnson fired struck anyone. Turning to the Metro and Iowa section. Article here, despite standoff, Black Lives Matter protest ends peacefully. Demonstrators detailed their demands to police. A standoff between police and Black Lives Matter marchers ended without incident Saturday after the two parties negotiated a peaceful end to the demonstration at Papa John's Sculpture Park. The denouement of tensions came just days after police arrested about 20 near the Iowa Capitol on Monday using what protesters said were aggressive use of pepper spray, pushing protesters, and using kettling techniques, a controversial tactic that surrounds demonstrators before making arrests. Police in riot gear and protesters stood face-to-face for nearly an hour after the march was pushed down from Ingersoll Avenue along 15th Street to Grand Avenue. During that time, protesters detailed their demands, including an investigation into Monday's arrests, an executive order from Governor Kim Reynolds that would allow those with felony convictions to vote, the decriminalization of marijuana, and an end to school resource officer program. Eventually, police and a number of the group's leaders negotiated an end to the demonstration, which police agreeing to leaving the area if the protesters would remain in the sculpture park and not block traffic. The march began in the sculpture park and moved east down Locust Street, stopping traffic in front of Des Moines restaurants and drawing curious looks from diners and drivers as the protesters chanted. The group then went north to Grand Avenue and up 15th to Ingersoll Avenue, where police in riot gear stopped them from advancing west or going east into downtown. The group went back down 15th Street and off the street at the corner of the Sculpture Park. Police stood in the intersection facing the group, which danced and listed its demands. There was no violence or destruction of property. By the time the end was negotiated, fewer than 50 protesters remained. Those that were still there dispersed peacefully into the Sculpture Park, where organizer Matthew Bruce encouraged them to attend a demonstration Monday at the Iowa Capitol. A Black Lives Matter demonstration in support of the Black LGBTQ community, planned for Sunday, was postponed after the killing of a Des Moines man early Sunday morning outside a nightclub just north of the city. Tyler Davis writes, "Suit says Drake breached contract. Belgian athletes claim scholarships pulled. Drake University promised two European tennis players tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships, only to renege on that agreement after the teens moved to the U.S., according to a lawsuit filed this month. Davidson Kozlowski, the Bulldogs' men's tennis coach, allegedly promised Max and Ralph Maas, twins from Belgium, academic and athletic scholarships totaling more than $30,000 per year apiece to attend Drake. The Maas family was told if the brothers enrolled in January of 2019 on their own dime, they would receive athletic and academic scholarships for the upcoming semesters," the lawsuit states. But 5 months after they arrived in Des Moines, Kozlowski told them that they would not be receiving an athletic scholarship in the fall, breaching an oral contract, according to the petition and jury demand filed June 15th in Polk County. Drake reneged on the promise for athletic scholarships because other tennis players lost their eligibility for academic scholarships, prompting Drake to reallocate the promised athletic scholarships for the Maas brothers, the lawsuit states. A university spokesman said Drake is disputing the allegations, but will not comment further on the litigation. The Maas brothers are no longer enrolled at the private university and have no place to play comparable competitive tennis at home in Belgium, says Jason Sutchin, an attorney who works with collegiate and professional athletes. The brothers were told in June of 2019 they would not receive the athletic scholarships for the fall semester. They say that did not give them time to find a new place to play and attend school. The boys did not sign a national letter of intent, but had an agreement on how much attending Drake should have cost for 4 years after having a redshirt season. Whether or not it was done through an NLI, whether or not it was done through a grant and an aid agreement is irrelevant to us because these were promises that were made to these people who were induced to come to Iowa from Belgium, Sutchin said. Sutchin is advising Vernon Squires, a lawyer with Bradley and Riley PC, who is representing the Maas family. Bart Maas, listed along with his sons as plaintiffs in the case, spent about $40,000 to move his sons to Iowa, court records state. They're twins, and that's what made this particularly egregious, Sutchin told the Register. The father would have the burden to pay for two kids to be at Drake. So when the school did not fulfill their commitment to the Maas family, it would have resulted in two times the financial burden on the father. They haven't returned to the U.S. since going home last summer. The revocation of the scholarship money was a breach of contract, the lawsuit states. The father understood what the promise was, as did the boys, and that changed, Suchin said. He said the brothers and their father were very careful about what college to choose during their 2018 search and had several options. They eventually connected with Kozlowski, foregoing other opportunities, the suit says. Max and Ralph Moss were drawn to Drake's training facilities and world-class education, Suchin said. In early December of 2018, the Mosses learned that attending the school would cost more than anticipated. They talked to Kozlowski about the price that month, according to the suit. During this call, Kozlowski promised them a precise amount of academic and athletic scholarship aid Drake would provide, the lawsuit states. This amount was memorialized during the December 3, 2018 call in a spreadsheet the Moss brothers prepared with Kozlowski's involvement. The twins and their father provided the coach with their calculations of the cost and asked if there were any inaccuracies. According to the lawsuit, Kozlowski acknowledged their work and did not alert them to any issues. Due to their conversations with the coach, the family anticipated $36,000 in aid per year for each brother beginning in the fall of 2019, and $54,000 in aid for the years 2021-22 and 22-23, court records show. Athletic scholarships made up about half of the scholarship money. There were promises made, commitments that were made that induced them to select Drake over other opportunities. Obviously, it's a major commitment to leave Belgium, to come all the way to Iowa to play tennis and go to school, Suchin said. For them to have made that effort, they had to feel comfortable that those commitments were going to be met. And it's their position that the commitments were not met. Also on the front page of the Metro in Iowa, man charged with murder, robbery after body discovered. A Des Moines man was arrested on first-degree murder and first-degree robbery charges after body was found Saturday night with a gunshot injury in an industrial area southeast of downtown Des Moines. Patrol officers found the man's body along the roadside in the 2400 block of East Market Street just after 9 p.m., while responding to the report of a person down, according to a Des Moines Police Department news release. Police determined the death was a homicide Sunday morning, stating the victim had a gunshot injury. Andrew James Hall, age 27, of Ankeny, was arrested for first-degree murder and first-degree robbery and booked into Polk County Jail just after 10 a.m. The victim's name is being withheld until family notifications have been completed. The killing was the 14th homicide in Des Moines this year. It was the first of two overnight shootings in the Des Moines Metro. Sir William Beckage, age 29, a Des Moines chef and party promoter, was shot in the head and killed early Sunday morning outside Karma Ultra Lounge, 4995 Mulhay Road. Bar staffers called police around 1:30 a.m. to help disperse a crowd of about 500 people inside and outside the bar, according to the Polk County Sheriff's Office news release. Shots rang out outside the bar at 1:49 a.m. Two women were shot in the incident, but were able to drive themselves to the hospital and survived. And from Cedar Rapids, investigator excels at locating people. His doggedness earns an award in Linn County. When prosecutors are tracking down a witness, looking for that one statement that confirms a victim's story or helps prove the defendant's guilt, they turn to their best man who never gives up. Al Steele is humble and probably would say he's the best, but 21 criminal, civil, and juvenile prosecutors would beg to differ. Steele, age 59 of Cedar Rapids, who retired after 36 years in law enforcement, made it only 5 months before taking another job as the investigator for the Linn County Attorney's Office. His friend, Jim Noonan, had been the office's investigator for 8 years and reached out to see if Steele was interested in taking over after he retired. "He just passed away a few months ago," Steele said. "Jim was one of the nicest human beings. Whatever Jim said was golden with me." Steele was hired and started with the office nearly 5 years ago. "I love talking to people," he told the Cedar Rapids Gazette. "I love my job. There's no stress for me. It's the most fun I ever had." He insists that he's just part of the support staff. He said the prosecutors and the other staff are the ones working hard every day on the cases to help the community and victims. The prosecutors see Steele as an important part of the team, and recently nominated him for the Exemplary Service Award for Customer Satisfaction, a quarterly award given to Linn County employees. He received the award this month. "When I need an answer that requires boots on the ground, I know Al is the man to get the job done," First Assistant Linn County Attorney Nick Maybank said. "When I have a tough task on a case, I put my best man on it." Maybanks calls Steele a jack of all trades because he follows up on law enforcement investigations, tracks down key evidence and people who don't want to be found, and serves numerous subpoenas every day for felonies, misdemeanors, and civil cases. Maybanks had a recent drunken driving case in which a defendant with two previous convictions was accused of crashing his car into a retaining wall. He claimed his passenger was the driver. Steele went to the scene to follow up with witnesses and reviewed body camera footage and 911 calls, which showed the defendant was the driver. The defendant ended up going to prison because of Steele's efforts, Maybanks said. Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter said Steele always comes up with new and innovative ways to track down people. If Elle can't find them, no one can, she said. Slaughter had a tough domestic abuse case with a victim who was 29 weeks pregnant and badly assaulted. The woman recanted her statement that the defendant, who had been convicted twice, had beat her. Slaughter had to go to trial in less than a week. She asked Steele to find additional witnesses who could testify about the victim's demeanor, appearance, and injuries, and he did. He also obtained surveillance video that showed the victim upset and crying when she called police from a convenience store. Then he found the victim, who wouldn't respond to Slaughter. He had a gut feeling that she was living with the defendant, so he staked out the house for 8 hours. He eventually found the victim on social media and persuaded her to come outside to accept the subpoena. The defendant was convicted, but Slaughter said the case would have never seen the inside of a courtroom without Steele collecting the additional evidence. Anastasia Basquin, chief victim liaison and community outreach specialist with the office, said the secret to Steele's success is that he can talk with and relate to anybody. He treats everybody with kindness and respect. Asked how he seems to find those nuggets of information that make the case, Steele said he relies on a lot of resources and a few little tactics he learned from his time with law enforcement. But he added that he also strikes out sometimes. Steele grew up near Charles City in a farming family. Nobody in his family was in law enforcement. Yet Steele said he knew in 6th or 7th grade that he wanted to be a police officer. He applied to be a part-time dispatcher at age 15 and got the job. It was the coolest job ever, he said with a grin. I wasn't nervous or stressed. It was a small town. After finishing a Friday night wrestling match, he would go to the police department, where he would sleep in the jail for a few hours until his midnight shift. Steele had planned to go into the Marines, but instead, at 18, joined the Iowa Department of Public Safety's Capitol Police in Des Moines. They provided security for the Capitol building and the governor and his family. He also started taking classes at Des Moines Area Community College, where he met his wife, Michelle. He became a state trooper, then worked in narcotics, and eventually the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. He retired in 2015 as a special agent in charge. Steele said he's good at his job because it's all about people. It just requires being patient and never giving up, which isn't in my DNA. He uses social media and scours all the reports to locate people and evidence, such as surveillance video. He said dealing with people is all in the approach. With witnesses, he explains to them that a case is like a puzzle, and each piece of evidence puts it together. I tell them up front that I need to serve a subpoena, Steele said. Some people may not even realize they could be a witness in a case. In one case, there was a guy who called 911 but said police never talked to him and he didn't think about being a witness. And here is a recent update on the COVID-19 in Iowa. As of 10 a.m. Sunday, the state of Iowa was reporting no additional COVID-19 deaths and an additional 543 confirmed cases since the state's tally from 10 a.m. Saturday. Total confirmed cases is now at 28,478. Total deaths, 704. Total recovered, 17,573, and total tested, 295,920. Joel Shannon writes, a poll says most want major police reforms. Most Americans believe change must be made to law enforcement across the nation, and that reforms are needed to reduce police brutality against Black Americans, a poll found. Among the ideas embraced by many of those polled on June 18th through the 22nd by Ipsos on behalf of Public Agenda and USA Today include forcing officers to reapply for their jobs to help weed out bad cops, limit the scope of policing to focus on serious and violent crimes, and cut off police departments' ability to buy military gear. Those reforms are in addition to widespread and bipartisan support for more training and de-escalation tactics and racial biases, as well as numerous reforms aimed at increasing transparency. The poll surveyed 1,113 U.S. adults as part of the Hidden Common Ground Initiative, which focuses on agreement and disagreement on solutions to tough public problems. The online poll has a credibility interval akin to a margin of error of plus or minus 3.3 percentage points for respondents. The data came after weeks of nationwide protests calling for racial equality and an end to police brutality. In respondent LaLage Carruthers, 83 years, she has never seen such far-reaching attention on the issues. An African-American woman living in Shelby, North Carolina, she can remember the end of segregation, her daughter's school integrating, and a federal mandate that her nursing unit do the same. But now, Americans' ongoing reckoning with racial inequality is extending to even historical symbols of slavery and racism, especially Confederate statues. It's unlike anything Carruthers has seen before. It's a problem with the whole system, she said. About 3 in 4 people surveyed say racial bias against black Americans is a serious problem in the U.S. Slightly fewer say it's a problem in their community. Asked whether racism is a problem with individuals or society, respondents were more likely to say both. More than half said major changes or a total redesign were needed. Few believe things should stay the way they are. Only 7% want to leave current policing and law enforcement the way it is. Some officers will profile black people. I know I can get away with more things as a white person than a black person could, Yismo Rosenberg of Houston said. He thinks poor training among officers is likely to blame. The poll found several reforms that focused around training and diversity in policing had support from 3/4 or more of respondents. Requiring all officers to undergo training on de-escalation tactics to avoid the use of force. Requiring all officers to undergo training on how to be less racially biased. And recruiting more black Americans to become police officers. Even more popular, numerous transparency reforms. 9 in 10 respondents support having officers wear body cameras. 8 in 10 support requiring police departments to publicly report all incidents involving the use of force within 72 hours. And nearly as many support creating a national public database of officers who have used excessive force and prohibiting other jurisdictions from rehiring them. More extreme forms of police reform have varying levels of support, often with partisan divides. But the poll found 2 major reforms were supported by more than half of poll takers. Focusing policing on serious or violent crimes, and requiring all police officers to reapply for their jobs, hiring back and retraining only the most qualified. The poll identified several specific examples of responsibilities that more than half of respondents thought could be done by other professionals rather than police. Sending social workers and EMTs to respond to mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence issues. Assigning social workers and counselors to monitor school safety. And using cameras, drones, and other technologies to enforce traffic laws. Democrats were more likely to support these reductions to officers' responsibilities. But some are skeptical those reforms would work. Rosenberg, a Republican who has a military background, believes sending social workers in situations that could involve weapons, such as domestic violence disputes, would lead to widespread deaths and injuries. And while rehiring officers could help, Ed Harrell, age 42, of Jacksonville, Florida, was skeptical that the process would be able to identify bad officers. They're going to do what it takes to get the job. The poll also documented support for police was common, with nearly 3/4 of respondents saying disrespect of police officers was a serious problem, and about half saying police budgets should stay the same or increase. Reducing funding to police departments, a rallying cry for many protesters, received support from about 1/3 of respondents. Divisions along party lines were fairly common in the poll, especially in how widespread the problem is and how many changes are needed. For example, Democrats were about 3 times more likely to want major changes or a redesign of policing than Republicans. One core disagreement that can be seen in political and racial divides, the nature and prevalence of racism in policing. Nearly 70% of black Americans felt that police use excessive force against black Americans is a widespread problem. But only about 25% of white respondents thought so. Also in the metro in Iowa, Task Force for Law Enforcement Equity forms. Police across Iowa and the local branch of the NAACP are partnering on a task force to improve relations and communication between law enforcement and communities they patrol. The Law Enforcement Vision for Equality Task Force, created by the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP and the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, will help ensure unbiased policing in Iowa, according to Betty C. Andrews, president of the NAACP branch. A joint news release published from the branch and the Police Chiefs Association said the force was created to help form better relationships between police and residents. Iowa City NAACP President Kevin Sanders and Old Wine Police Chief Jeremy Logan, a past president of the IPCA, will head the 14-person committee, which will hear concerns about police procedures and develop proposals for change. Logan emphasized that the task force is an opportunity for Iowa law enforcement to hear citizen concerns and respond to changing needs in the community. This collaborative effort with our minority stakeholders will provide a balanced review of the efforts of Iowa law enforcement agencies and provide guidance towards ways to improve how we serve our communities while developing trust and strong relationships to continue to evolve the service provided to our community members, he said. A trio of community leaders from across the state and representatives from Iowa law enforcement agencies joined 3 county sheriffs and 4 police chiefs on the board. Stephen Bayens, commissioner of the Iowa Department of Public Safety, and a couple of retired officers were also named to the task force. This open exchange will allow for all parties to have their voice heard with an open mind towards understanding what is currently happening in our communities and why it is happening, and what we can collaboratively do to improve on it, the release states. Andrews thinks it could lead to uniform accreditation for law enforcement across Iowa and further police training covering de-escalation tactics, cultural competency, and implicit bias. We feel it is a strong opportunity for policing in the state of Iowa, Andrews said. And from Hopkinton, Eastern Iowa Group wants to ensure all kids have a real bed. During church one morning, Keith Kramer glanced down at a bulletin that listed church updates. As he continued to skim the flyer, he noticed a sentence or two about an organization he had never heard of before. It had a brief description that mentioned providing kids with beds. After reading more in a local newspaper and doing some research, Kramer found a Jones County chapter of the national organization Sleep in Heavenly Peace, and he knew he needed to talk to someone about starting it in his area. I was just looking for something different, said Kramer, who also serves on the board of Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque. You see a food bank, and that is an ongoing deal, but a bed can also make a difference for their lifetime. I thought we could do the project and make a difference in Delaware County. After meeting with Heather Weirs, the chapter president in Jones County, Kramer was hooked. He saw the need Jones County had among youth lacking beds and realized it was something overlooked in Delaware County as well. I think it's needed to get these kids off the floor, or lots of times they are sharing beds or sometimes it's a couch, Kramer told the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. They aren't sleeping right. I think it boosts their confidence level when they start realizing they've got their own bed and they are always going to sleep better. Early this year, Kramer flew to Idaho, where Sleep in Heavenly Peace is based, along with Lynn Chestnut, who also was interested in helping start a chapter in Delaware County. It's a great organization that is going to definitely benefit the kids of our local county, Chestnut said. It is a definite eye-opener. I don't think there was a need in our area, but there definitely is. In order to get equipment and supplies needed to make the beds, Kramer reached out to local businesses and individuals for donations. I just continue to spread the word, Kramer said. I've got a lot of good friends who've always supported my projects, and I talked to some church groups who also made homemade quilts for the beds. So far, the Sleep in Heavenly Peace organization has only delivered one bed to a child in Delaware County, but it has supplies and equipment to make and donate many more. We did one build just prior to this shutdown, and we completed 18 beds, Chestnut said. We did a team build where we brought in a group of people and built a bunch of beds in a few hours. Now that the state is reopening, volunteers with Sleep in Heavenly Peace are ready to begin delivering beds and hope to start a group build with a local church, businesses, and other Delaware County organizations, Chestnut said. In Jones County, Weir said she had no idea how needed the beds were until the Jones County Partnership for Protecting Children received a $1,500 grant to provide area children with beds in 2018. The grant money was gone in a month, said Weirs, a coordinator with the Jones County PPC. I started researching and learned about Sleep in Heavenly Peace in Cedar Rapids. Weir said it has been less than a year since she started the chapter in Jones County, and already 100 beds have been donated to families in the county. I would say we have hit every age range of recipients, Weir said. It is just something you never think about, and just to help that child have their own bed is a big deal. Although the excitement surrounding the Delaware County chapter ended as soon as it began because of the pandemic, Chestnut said they are ready to bring the momentum back. "You can do something that is beneficial for kids in your neighborhood," he said. "There are needs you don't even realize people in your own backyard have. It's really great to see the joy in the kids' faces when they get a bed to sleep in." Regulators back off major liquor price hike. The government agency that regulates liquor sales in Iowa said Thursday it has backed off a major price increase for some products that it proposed to reduce heavy drinking. Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division spokesman Tyler Ackerson confirmed that distributors were notified last week of the price increase that was planned for July 1st. But he said the notice created negative feedback from suppliers and other stakeholders, and that the agency has dropped the plan indefinitely. Ackerson said distributors were concerned about the economic impact, particularly during the coronavirus pandemic. The planned increase had already been delayed from May 1st to July 1st after it was initially floated in February. Ackerson said the agency still believes that the plan is good public policy and that will be revisited later. Bars and restaurants that are facing a loss of business from the coronavirus would have been forced to pay higher prices for many products under the change. The division's notice said that it had decided to set a minimum unit price for liquor based on bottle size and alcohol by volume. The notice said that research has shown such pricing can lead to a reduction in heavy consumption of alcoholic beverages, as well as a reduction in alcohol-caused deaths. Supporters say such plans can make sure that liquor isn't too cheap, and that its price factors in societal impacts of drinking. The notice released by the agency to the Associated Press under the Open Records Law said that a bottle of Castillo rum would have increased from $12.50 to $13.81, or by 10.5%. After this article was written, there was a follow-up article, "Industry Lobbyist Helped Kill Price Hike on Iowa Liquor." Opposition from lobbyists for the liquor and restaurant industry to help kill a price increase on alcohol products in Iowa that was intended to discourage unhealthy heavy drinking, emails released Friday show. The Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division announced on June 5th that it would implement a price floor for liquor products beginning July 1st. The plan would have set a minimum unit price for liquor based on bottle size and alcohol by volume. The change would have meant higher prices for vodka, rum, whiskey, and other liquor at stores, restaurants, and bars, ranging from roughly 10% to 30% more for some products. The division said research shows such pricing can reduce heavy consumption and alcohol-related deaths, but it shelved the plan June 12th after getting feedback from suppliers and other stakeholders. Emails released to the Associated Press through an open records request show those raising concerns included representatives for the national liquor producers Sazerac and Luxco, whose companies market scores of brands. Sazerac lobbyist wrote to a top aide to Governor Kim Reynolds that the pricing change obviously hurts consumers as well as small businesses. That email was forwarded to the division's administrator, Stephen Larson. Larson received an email June 8th warning him that the plan would disproportionately affect products favored by African Americans, which was insane at a time like this. The AP was unable to determine the corporate affiliation of the person who sent the email, John Young. Young said Larson had 24 hours to retract the plan or he would face scrutiny from the governor's office and be plunged into the middle of a media storm. The Iowa Restaurant Association president, Jessica Dunker, criticized the plan in a voicemail and later phone call with Larson and told him in an email, "You can imagine my distress. Restaurants and bars have been devastated by the coronavirus pandemic, and they are worried a price hike would undermine their sales and profits." Democratic Senator Claire Chelsea has criticized the agency for backing down, noting that deaths from alcohol addiction have risen dramatically in Iowa over the last decade. On Twitter, she said the legislators should act if regulators do not. The division says it still believes the price floor plan is good public policy and will be revisited another time. The commission that oversees the agency voted Tuesday to install as its chairperson Christine Spratt, a vice president of alcohol distribution company in Mount Pleasant. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic and its effect on the alcoholic beverages industry, the work of the commission and the alcoholic beverages division to properly balance business opportunities with the protection of public health, safety, and welfare will be vital, she said in a statement. And from the Associated Press, Reynolds compliments Trump on administration of action to help workers. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds told President Donald Trump on Friday that HIS is an administration of action that is identifying barriers and gaps for U.S. workers and finding solutions. Reynolds is a member of the American Workforce Policy Advisory Board, which Trump established by executive order last year. Trump's daughter and advisor, Ivanka Trump, and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross chair the panel. Its goal is to develop and implement a strategy to revamp the American workforce to better meet the challenges of the 21st century. Video provided by the White House includes Reynolds praising Trump for creating the board. What I so appreciate about your administration is that it really is an administration of action, she told Trump, sitting three chairs away from him and next to Larry Kudlow, the president's top economic advisor. Ivanka Trump announced at the meeting that the president planned to sign an order extending the board's assignment for another year to further implement pilot projects the group had initiated. And from Flagstaff, Arizona, hard-hit tribe takes strict steps, says virus turned our world upside down. People in the deserts of Arizona flee to the White Mountains when the triple-digit heat is too much to bear, cooling off in the forest a few hours away. That worries a Native American tribe that calls the area home, as coronavirus infections and temperatures have both spiked in one of the hardest-hit states. The White Mountain Apache tribe is taking some of the most drastic actions in Arizona to protect its 13,500 residents, more than one-eighth of whom have already tested positive for COVID-19. It's taking cues from several measures imposed by other tribes nationwide, including the Navajo Nation, which has curtailed an outbreak that once made it a national hotspot. Those living on the White Mountain Apache Tribe's reservation in northeastern Arizona face the risk of fines and other penalties if they venture beyond their own yards over the weekend. A two-week shelter-in-place order will follow. The tribe's Fort Apache Reservation also is closed to the summertime visitors who flock to the area to fish, hike, and camp among ponderosa pines. The tribe's confirmed infections and 20 deaths as of Friday make the reservation one of the hardest-hit places in a state that's recording over 3,000 cases a day and running short on hospital space. COVID has just turned our world upside down, White Mountain Apache Chairwoman Gwen Denna Lee Gatewood said. The tribe also is ordering homeless people who test positive for the virus to quarantine at the tribe's casino hotel, now closed to visitors, and is banning the sale and use of alcohol for the rest of the year. Lee Gatewood hopes it will help keep people safe if they get lax about social distancing and other measures when they're drinking. The tribe's strict steps come as Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has declined to impose new restrictions on businesses like other states where confirmed cases are surging. Fellow Republican governors in Texas and Florida cracked down on bars Friday. Ducey, who lifted a stay-at-home order in mid-May, has now paused further efforts to reopen the economy and allowed cities to require face coverings, without bowing to pressure for a statewide mandate. Lee Gatewood said the White Mountain Apache tribe took that into consideration, along with the typical summer crowds, when deciding to target the pandemic on its land. We're seeing these visitors not paying attention to social distancing and wearing masks, and the governor had a real relaxed attitude about all of that in reopening the businesses back up, she said. Elsewhere in Arizona, officials on the Havasupai Reservation, deep in a gorge off the Grand Canyon, warned river rafters that they would be tamed if they stepped foot on land the tribe traditionally uses but isn't part of its formal reservation. Known worldwide for its towering blue-green waterfalls, the reservation has been shut down for months and has no reported COVID-19 cases. We are left to take aggressive action to maintain the safety of our tribal members and the future of the Havasupai tribe, Chairwoman Evangeline Kissoon wrote in a notice to river guides. After talking with Grand Canyon National Park, the tribe said it would station law enforcement at its boundary with the park, miles from the Colorado River shore. The nearby Navajo Nation, the nation's largest Native American reservation that spans part of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, has attributed a slowdown in affections to a daily curfew it's had in place for months, a shutdown of government offices and tourist sites, weekend lockdowns, and a mask requirement. On tribal land elsewhere, residents of the tiny Alaska Native village of Napiskiok are being advised to stay home until July 5th, leaving only for medical needs or quick runs to the grocery store. A health care corporation that serves the village and dozens of other rural communities pointed to a strong likelihood of community spread. In Montana, tribal leaders on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation said this week that they closed their boundary with Popular Glacier National Park for the tourism season to protect their residents. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota has kept up roadblocks since March despite criticism from the state's governor. Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier said last week that the tribe took steps because it realized it had to protect its people. "All we have is ourselves," he said. In Arizona, the White Mountain Apache tribe said people can travel on a highway through its land, but they can't stop along the way. Tribal police also are considering checkpoints, and a COVID-19 testing blitz is planned. "There's frustration. There's impatience. There's a lot of things," Tribal Councilman Gerald Otaha said in a video. "But remember, we are doing the best we can. We are doing everything we can to help you." They're looking to prevent more people from dying, like Apache elder Timothy Clausen, Sr., age 91. He married his sweetheart under a tree on a reservation and spent his life in the White Mountains working as a rancher and at a sawmill. Lee Gatewood, the tribal chairwoman, recalled their last conversation. Clausen called earlier this month and said, "Well, chairwoman, I'm at the hospital, and they told me I have this virus. They treated me, and the doctor said I wouldn't leave here, and I'm calling to say my goodbyes." Lee Gatewood said Clausen told her that he was proud of her. "You're a tough cowboy," she responded. "I'll keep you in my prayers." The next day, Lee Gatewood got a text from Clausen's granddaughter. He had died. And finally, Democrats warn against becoming overconfident. President Donald Trump is entering the final four-month stretch before Election Day, presiding over a country that faces a public health crisis, mass unemployment, and a reckoning over racism. His Democratic challenger, Joe Biden, is raking in cash, and a series of national and battleground polls suggests growing obstacles to Trump's re-election. But the election is far from decided. Biden and his leading supporters warn Democrats to avoid becoming complacent. Former President Barack Obama and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer insist that plenty could change before November 3rd and that the party must be vigilant against Trump. "We understand about what happens 5 months before elections, and what happens at the election can be very different things," Whitmer said. Michigan was one of the Midwestern states that Trump carried by a thin margin in 2016, helping him win the Electoral College even as he lost the popular vote. Other Democrats in the state warned the strength of the president's support should not be underestimated. "If the election were held today, I think Biden would win Michigan," Michigan Representative Debbie Dingell said. "But the Trump supporters are out there, and they're still intense." Obama underscored that point last week during his first joint fundraiser with Biden. "We can't be complacent or smug or suggest that somehow it's so obvious that this president hasn't done a good job," Obama told thousands of donors who gathered online. "He won once, and it's not like we didn't have a good clue as to how he was going to operate the last time." Still, the current dynamics don't fit seamlessly with 2016. Trump benefited 4 years ago from Clinton being almost as unpopular as he was. In Biden, Trump faces an opponent with a stronger standing among some groups of voters, especially independents, than Clinton had. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thank you for listening.